Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle. We're going to do something a little different today. We're going to take a stroll down memory lane. The reason for that is so many candidates vying for the presidency are talking about the good old days, about when America was great, etc., etc. It's a constant theme. Well, some of us are getting to a point where we can remember the good old days, and some things were quite wonderful, and some things weren't as wonderful. To take this stroll, arm in arm, as it were, at least metaphorically, I'm joined by Robert Whitcomb, who's not as old as I am, I rush to say, and who is the adjunct fellow at the Pell Center, which is a think tank in Newport, Rhode Island, a former journalist with the Wall Street Journal, with the Rhode Island newspaper, and many other activities. Also has a website, New England.
New England Diary.
New England Diary. It's jolly good. You can read my columns on it. And Linda Gasparella, the co-host of this program. I can't forget you, Linda, can I?
Oh, I'm so glad your memory hasn't let you down.
Thank you. And I will assure you that Linda is much younger than I am.
It's like the memory holds out through the show.
But it's the little things that have changed. The big things we know about. We know about the internet, but the little things in daily life, we thought we'd talk about how they've changed. And we're going to start by talking about how menus have changed. I can remember when there were certain standard things on menus, and Linda and Bob will help me with this, but there was always a half grapefruit with a cherry stuck in it. There was always a New Zealand lobster tail, i.e. not a real lobster at all, a crayfish tail, and it had been frozen, but it appeared on many, many menus, etc. Linda, what do you remember of menus of, say, half a century ago, or not quite half a century? Or
all right, what I really remember about menus was that there was a level of formality in the menus. There was a level of eating and of ceremony in the menus that really suggested a formality. And that formality meant that the menus included many, many courses. I remember very fondly the relish tray. Bob, you remember this.
Yes, it was revolting.
Every New England restaurant had the relish tray.
Well, it wasn't just New England. I mean, in Washington, the great National Press Club in Washington, it had
of course
a relish tray.
That's
and
right,
it
relish.
Was always brought up, and you know, if you were a little short of money, you could eat the relish
over
the bread and butter and say, I'm not hungry tonight.
Over sugared relish with sort of carcinogenic elements to
The relish trays were something that were a nice way to begin the dinner. Yeah. And then I think what happened to them they disappeared when I think the MBAs got into the restaurant business.
It was celery, radishes.
Right.
You had pickled relishes. You had sometimes herrings on them. You had all sorts of things.
Oh, yes,
that
the would herring.
I missed the herring.
Herrings or sardines or something.
Exactly.
Right.
There'd be things like that.
It was basically cocktail party food.
Yeah, and then there would be somebody would come by, the roll lady. Remember, she would come by with these
that
wonderful.
That was her job.
And then the front was the cigarette lady.
Right. And there was cigarette lady too.
Cigarettes.
But this tremendous sort of, you know, formality that you had in restaurants. So certainly restaurants in the 50s
and they didn't
and
give
the
you their first names.
No,
who started that? And why are all waiters named Bruce?
Bruce. Well if they're in Australia, they are.
Well,
here it's Bob.
Well, I don't want to know their first
just
name.
For the
they
fun
shouldn't
of,
know mine.
We, for the fun of it, I want to say one day when one of these waitresses or waiters comes to and says, my name is Bruce, I'm your wait person, I want to say, my name is King. I'm your customer. Please remember it. But I'm looking at this menu here of that period, 1974, and how cheap it is, at the very expensive Simpsons in the Strand in London, which is a very classic English restaurant.
Yeah, fancy place.
Well, not so fancy. It's very English, with roast beef and game. But it also has lots of things that just you don't see these days. Roast grouse, for example. Game chips. They're roast pheasant. Very English. Steak, kidney, and mushroom pie delicious, I assure you.
Instant,
don't listen to him.
Instant
they
coronary
are delicious.
Infarction.
They
how
are
about
delicious.
How about curried mutton, rice and chutney? That was also a,
actually that's good.
We had that. We had that in menus in the United States.
We had chutney in a lot of stuff.
There was a curry. Yeah, there was always a curry.
Somebody chutney sort of disappeared.
Well, chutney
chutney
now,
was on the relish tray if you cared to
now
eat
they
it.
Use,
shades of S.S. Pierce Company.
Now they,
that's right,
they describe various things. They dress things with this chutney, but it's not really a classic. Remember, the classic was Major Gray's chutney.
That's right. And, yeah, that was the official
it
one.
It came from India, and it was always the same.
It was mango chutney.
It was made from mangoes. It wasn't made from gooseberries or anything else. And now they make it out of almost anything. Anyway, let me go on looking at this. I was actually in 1974 in this restaurant. Some of these things I remember.
You were working in the kitchen.
No, I was not working in the kitchen. I was rather more prosperous then than I am today. Not everything gets better with time. Stewed tripe and onions
with tripe.
Creamed potatoes. Or omelette on a dinner menu.
That's true.
That's good. Yeah.
But the most amazing thing, honestly, on the Simpsons menu, Llewellyn, is the fact that after you have finished this glorious meal, it is followed by something called a savory. Savories are things like mushrooms and bacon on toast, Welsh rarebit.
Yeah, that's disappeared. That was after, but that wasn't very American. That didn't
no,
that,
we're just saying
that
this
never
is
really
a,
got to America.
That was very.
We did. Some of our restaurants
really?
Did have
Boston
them. Oh, sure, they did.
Like that?
Hotel restaurants did. If you went to a hotel restaurant,
actually,
in New York,
the Ritz may have had
absolutely.
That. Absolutely,
the old
Ritz
Carlton in Boston
right.
had.
Along with unsalted
I remember,
butter.
I remember right. when a lot of hotel restaurants were very pretentious and having French names on things. And not very good cooking at all. Let's move on.
May when I just say, Scotch Whitcock is a savory Llewellyn. That is scrambled eggs. Can you imagine us eating scrambled eggs after a huge dinner at Simpsons? But people do.
Well, people do.
You eat scrambled eggs drunk after drinking too much champagne.
And you would have that
at
2 Simpsons, believe me.
Right.
There's a great story about Henry Luce, who created Time magazine. It wasn't. It was his rival. Lord Beaverbrook, the British publisher,
the
who was standing at the wall. Well, yeah,
let's face
Britain
it, a Canadian.
Was,
yeah.
Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah. He lived in England. Eventually, most of his life, actually, after he'd made a lot of money in Canada, he went to England and lived it up. But anyway, he was staying at his suite, permanent residence he had in the Waldorf Astoria in New York, and the foreign editor of his newspaper, the Daily Express, was invited to have a business discussion, and knowing that he was going to see Lord Beaverbrook and have a wonderful dinner, he didn't eat on the plane. He was famished, but he was ready for rows and rows of wonderful, delectable things served by great waiters. And he got there, and Beaverbrook said, looked at the menu and said, "It's not very good here. Have the scrambled eggs. It's just what I eat." and so he ate
he didn't dare order anything else.
Oh, no,
he was
not. Anyway, let's move on.
Beaverbrook by this time was
when
a religious figure.
For you, when did the modern age begin?
For me?
Yes.
For me? I would say when air conditioning became pervasive, even in cool parts of the United States. When we started getting air conditioning in cars and houses and homes. That, to me, was the great change. That would have been in the 60s.
It had, you know, in the 60s, electricity consumption was doubling every 10 years because of the effect of air conditioning.
Right.
But I remember working in New York,
in
newspapers in New York, the World Telegram and the New York Post. If you were an editor, you could do rather like a musician. You could do pickup work. You could go here, there, and going into these unbelievably hot places.
I have to tell the story. My first newspaper job, which I got
you don't
by
have
accident,
to, but I think
well, it's
you're
pretty
going
gruesome.
To.
It was in the Boston Record American, which was a terrible tabloid paper, being printed, being produced and printed in a big granite building in Winthrop Square in downtown Boston. They had no air conditioning there whatsoever. There was no breeze. It was this tight little area. And we had big stacks of salt tablet containers in the newsroom. People would keep taking salt tablets to avoid passing out.
Who could believe that you could be passed out in Boston?
There was a thermometer in there. One very hot day, around the 1st of August, I think it was 105 in that room.
Wow.
And despite the, you know, the big old fans.
People don't understand.
And everyone chain smoking.
Absolutely unattractive newsrooms were.
They
usually looked as though they were swimming pools that the water had been let out of. Yeah. And there was this mark on the wall.
After a cholera epidemic.
Yeah. They hadn't painted them
forever. No, no. They were
broken desks.
Paint.
And people would seek out the typewriter that they knew worked best. Yeah.
And there were liquor bottles everywhere. Yeah. And cigarette smoke. Holy moly.
And copy boys running around getting people coffee.
Linda, when did the modern age begin for you?
I think the modern age began for me in two ways, and it had to do with transportation. One, that you could fly to Paris very quickly, and so therefore I traveled a lot when I was very young.
And cheaply, you could do it
cheaply.
Take Icelandic Airlines.
Absolutely. You could, instead of the 20 hours it used to take to get to Europe, it took seven.
Yeah.
Okay, the second one was our highway system, when you could really get out and go. This transformed, I think, us into the modern age in no other way.
Well, the interstate highway system.
Yes.
For me, this is not nearly as dramatic, but for me, it began with push-button telephone. And as journalists, we make a lot of telephone calls.
Right.
And the old rotary dial was a, you know, we had special, we had pencils we did it with. You could get things that had a little gadget.
Yeah, you had a little thing that you
work.
Put into some of the holes to speed it up.
It was work.
Yeah.
And then at the World's Fair in New York City, I encountered the first push-button telephone. And I thought, this is a great advance. This is a marvelous gadget. And you know, there have been a lot of advances since then that have changed the nature of our work in journalism, largest of which may have been, well, there are many, but one of which was Xerox, because when we got a secret document, we had to copy it. All copy.
You know, of course, we had mimeograph machines.
Mimeographs.
Before
then.
It was great to drink mimeograph fluid.
But how about telex? Telex.
Telex started in the 19th century. I mean, telex was long established.
It's famously unreliable. You'd have these outages.
Telex and cable was how we communicated. Yeah. And there was actually an early form of fax, which was picture by wire.
Right.
And we'd have them in with all these photographs coming on this very skinny, very light onion skin paper, just coming and coming and coming in the newsroom. And we'd look up and say, hey, that looks like a good one. We'd cut it off.
That's right.
And send it off to be worked on by
the art
department.
All right, so for journalism, not having to deal with carbon copies anymore. Do you remember having to do that?
Yeah.
That
a book. We called it a book.
The book.
Book, yeah.
We always called it a book.
Royal Typer. What about the telegram, too? I could add, I think my world started to fall apart when telegrams disappeared. Because I love sending telegrams to people I did not want to deal with.
Well, you've got
to cancel an appointment.
Yes. Email. That's right.
And I was even more cowardly then than I am now. And I used to use these things as a very impersonal way of cutting off relationships. So I would send people telegrams and, you know, stop and all that stuff. And in my family, we've had a tradition of this. And I have scrapbooks in my cellar of telegrams going back to, I think, the late 19th century.
Well, they're
all negative.
Okay, so Bob.
One of the great user of telegrams was, of course, Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
There are telegrams, the one that he sent when Charles de Gaulle, who was a notoriously difficult man, was coming during the Second World War, coming to America. FDR asked him by telegram, because that's how you communicated, probably secure in some way, why he was sending him. And de Gaulle said, why am I forget, to have this inflicted on me. And Churchill wrote back, I have borne the cross of Lorraine long enough.
The heaviest cross he ever
There's
wore.
Another great, another great Churchill telegram, which was Winston Churchill, Winston Churchill, Bernard Shaw, the playwright, who was a socialist and very, very left wing. And nonetheless, they were friends. It was quite common at that time.
Yeah,
people
all the celebrities knew each other.
Diverse views, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And Shaw sent Churchill this telegram saying, I have reserved seats for you for first night. Bring a friend if you have one. And Churchill sends the telegram back, which says, can't make first nine. Please reserve two for second night if you have one. All right, let's move Great on stuff. Here. We need to do a little station identification for people who think they've tuned into the wrong channel. We're primarily doing this. This is White House Chronicle with me, Llewellyn King, and we are talking about the way things were. The program is as I said, White House Chronicle, which is seen on public television stations and PEG stations, which are the old public access stations. But particularly, we're doing this identification for our listeners on Sirius XM Radio Channel 124, where we have four airings, and we thank POTUS very much for that, of the audio from this program. As I said, my guest is Robert Whitcomb, who I didn't realize was as old as his narrative seems to intimate he is.
My aging is accelerating.
And Linda Gasparello, the co-host of this program.
Feeling younger by the moment.
This program can also be seen around the world on the English language stations of the Voice of America and on some of their radio broadcasts. I am, of course, Llewellyn King, if I can just about remember my own name. Obviously, I'm so old. Anyway. Some of the things that are different with time, little daily things that have changed enormously, apart from prices, which are out of sight. When I came to America in 1963 and lived in New York City, you tipped a taxi a nickel if it was a short ride, a quarter to a doorman for calling you a taxi, which was considered, you know, but there was no sort of easy in-between. You didn't want to give them two dimes. Now, that hasn't gone up that much compared to everything else, because people still give the doorman at a hotel anywhere a dollar usually. I give them $2
now. Five or something.
But things have changed there.
But you're saying what? Tipping is old fashioned?
No, I'm just saying that tipping was actually quite modest in those days. I didn't think it was all that great. 10% was considered a tip, and then it went up to 15. Now it's at 20%.
My father
was a very nice man, very generous man. He always tipped 20, even with bad service.
I think it
may have just been his reticence or something. But
do you tip in hotels?
I do.
I always do.
I do.
I always leave some
everywhere.
Money on the bed.
I always leave something for the maid because I think they're being mistreated. They are being grossly mistreated. And
they're
horrible work.
They're dealing with awful people and not just, what's his name, Dominique Strauss. I mean, there are a lot of people like that, but less famous.
Yeah, that's right.
Clothes have changed.
Okay, clothes. Yeah. Let's start on
clothes,
that
everybody used to be much more formal.
Yes.
So, all right, I'm going to blame this on a couple of things.
Show business,
rock musicians, the sloppiness. Nobody would throw somebody out of a great restaurant, whether it's France or New York or Boston, if you were Mick Jagger and you were wearing blue jeans, okay? Now that is de rigueur. Everybody can come in dressed sloppily. Right. And the other thing that changed was everybody wanted comfort. I think we have Lycra to blame. We have definitely Lycra
to
blame
easy.
For this. Yeah. Well,
there's no sense of occasion. The other thing is kind of the decline of sense of occasion. If you went on a trip, if you got on a train or a plane, you got dressed up. And to this day, folks, you still get better service if you do.
Absolutely.
I always wear a jacket and a tie getting on a plane. Everyone else is wearing these horrible T-shirts.
Oh, man, going through TSA these days,
no shoes.
Get dressed.
Well, if there's an argument, and there frequently is with airlines the way they are these days, it helps if you look as though you've got some substance.
But remember, going to the airport
was a huge thrill.
Everybody got dressed to go to the airport.
Yeah, of course, you look forward to it. Every other plane crashed then, but you know.
But Llewellyn said when you were living in London that you used to get dressed to go to dinner at Heathrow Airport, that it was like an occasion.
Oh, yes, airports were an occasion. Sure, yeah. They had good restaurants. Even JFK, anybody would go to JFK
for any
reason but to fly now is out of their mind.
But you look at the lack of
dressing.
It was
better when it was Idlewild. I traced the decline from the name change.
By the way, this also happened to Heathrow, which was called London Airport and then reverted to the area's previous name. When it was London Airport, we would go, and I was a young man, we'd actually go to restaurants in the airport on dates because they were quite good.
Yeah.
And one of the best steak au poivre I've ever had was at Kennedy in New York. You wouldn't go near an airport to eat now if you could possibly help it.
But you know, we got dressed to go to the theater. I remember one of the greatest thrills I had in New York was when I finally could afford a ticket to the Metropolitan Opera. And the night that I went, I got my long dress on, my best coat, my best shoes, and I thought, this is what you do when you go to the opera. Mm. And I saw that people weren't dressed. I felt like an utter fool.
Well,
there I was in this
church,
long dress.
Try church. My mother.
Church. Or church.
My mother would not have gone to church.
Funerals.
Without,
I was at a funeral a few weeks ago for a fairly well-known individual, distinguished individual. There were people there, several people there with T-shirts.
Well,
churches, people in cutoffs, people in sandals, and the theater likewise. And it's a terrible price for the theater, because the theater is the theater. And if you put on nice clothes, you join the play. If you dress up, you've heightened. You get a heightening of this theatricality of the event, which you don't get when people are dressed like slobs.
Right. You can imagine an actor looking out at the audience dressed up. Men in tuxes, you know, women in
opening nights
dresses.
In New York, people would show up in tails. It's a great scene of Cole Porter being carried in. You know, he was basically paralyzed from his shattered leg, and he was being carried in with a white tie and tails. And there were other people sitting there wearing the same.
But they had all they were dressed up. They were in the theater, playing a role in the theater. Now they're just, and this actually started.
It is.
The rot started.
The rock stars.
The rot started.
With the rock stars.
Not with the rock stars. Actually started with George Bernard Shaw.
No.
Him again.
He would insist on wearing this ghastly brown lounge suit when everybody wore dinner dress. And gradually, and then the socialists and the social, they used to call it kitchen sink drama.
John Osborne.
And people like Papp in New York, that this was, the theater was for everyone. You know, they had this idea, and it really did have this idea that you would park a truck that you were driving, and you would pop in, enjoy some Shakespeare, and then get back in the truck and drive overnight. And it didn't work. It didn't really work.
You know, Joe Papp's theater in New York being accessible didn't mean that you couldn't wear great clothes to go to the theater. It was absolutely accessible.
People were pulled down because he was doing stuff in Central Park.
I noticed that you have got this thing around your neck, and I bought one.
It's a noose.
Actually, neckties have gone practically. Hardly anybody wears them. Hats for men went altogether except in winter. That was JFK. My father would not go out anywhere without a hat.
There's a wonderful, I think it was Updike, John Updike or John Cheever story, kind of looking back to the 40s. He said, and all men wore hats. I still remember that.
And all men wore
all
hats.
All men wore hats, yeah. Well,
you remember journalists would put their press credentials
right
on the brim
fedora.
Of their hat? That's right.
Right.
Well, women wore them too. We had plenty of hats. Everybody had hat boxes. The other day I was looking around for a hat box, actually, to give somebody a gift, and I thought, I'm going to have to make this. I mean, I didn't think the hat box even exists anymore.
Yeah. By the way, I was once thrown out of a bar in Boston that you've probably been to because I was with a young woman who was wearing blue jeans.
Oh, I'm sure.
It was actually the Ritz Bar.
Oh, right. Oh, yes.
I came up, murmured in my, I'm sorry, we've served you a drink, sir, but you'll have to go. Now.
Well, the famous restaurant in New York, Cote Basque, would not seat men unless they put on ties. And they had a big supply of jackets and ties.
A lot of restaurants.
Clubs.
Clubs.
Well, and a lot of clubs
some of it was silly. I went to the Army-Navy Club in Washington with a friend of mine who had shingles, and they insisted. It was crazy. I said we should go to a restaurant. Anyway, what other ways? Of course, everything has changed with the electronics of our lives. We carry telephones with us. We carry electronic books with us.
Directions. People don't know how to read a map anymore. Now, I mean, it came down, I can never remember how to get to where we're right now, so I use GPS, and that's changed everything. So I don't bother looking anything up. So I'm really more ignorant than I used to be, because this little thing right here is telling me exactly what to do.
That's right.
I went all over Los Angeles 2 weeks ago, which I know nothing about with this.
Of course you could.
Telling me, take a left, take a right.
That has been a lifesaver for people who are directionally challenged, believe
me. I'm pretty good at directions, but this is better.
But, you know, remember the old argument?
The more you use these aids, the worse you become at what you are quite good at.
Well, it's like you can't, calculators, handheld calculators. So these people at these little stores, they don't know how to add or subtract.
That's very true. That's true. Yeah. May I say about the GPS, it has saved many a marriage. Remember how Dad would never ask for directions, your mother would always be at the gas station saying, ask for some directions?
Yeah, men don't ask directions.
Many marriages
you get the wrong direction.
I don't know, it's a testosterone thing or whatever. My wife yelling at me, ask directions. She can't take a joke.
Well, we've decided that the restaurants are different. We haven't decided they're worse. Certainly.
Better. Food's better.
There's a lot more fast food.
I think food is better.
Food is infinitely better.
A lot more fast food than there used to be.
Right.
Yeah. That's not better.
There's a lot of it. I mean, it's interesting how some people really don't know anything except fast food.
But that's what's different, the pace of life. We had much more time before, which gave us the formality with restaurants.
To read a novel.
Right, to read.
I read a lot of novels, but I read them on the carry around electronic book. So if I've got 5-10 minutes, I read. And I do read novels. But I remember, and this is not true, but I remember listening in Africa where I grew up to the sort of BBC
split-off.
Yeah. And somebody saying, well, it was called the transcription service, whatever that meant. But saying, well, before the Second World War, we used to read a novel a day. Now it's hard to finish one in a week.
That's right.
Of course, people were also often very bored. And I want to put a plug in here for the wonders of the internet, not in the way that you usually think of it. And that is, I do some work for a charity called, the disease is chronic fatigue syndrome, also known as myalgia encephalomyelitis, with an awful lot of bedridden people across the country and across the world. And their lives have been so improved and relieved by their ability to use social media. Just to learn from that they are not alone.
They're not.
Or to learn little
sense
things.
Sense of community.
And also just
you're
little
not as
bits
cut off
of
from
advice.
The world when you have the internet.
If you were bedridden in those days, A, you had to read, and if you couldn't read, you were in terrible, terrible shape. Either because you had never learned to read or for some other reason, you had no...
You couldn't get out to buy a book, and you couldn't go to a library, so you really were cut off.
That's right. Well, talking of cut off, it's time to cut you off, Linda.
I knew you were going to say
that. And you thought you'd been doing this program too long.
Call your lawyer.
And Bob Whitcomb, it's lovely to see you on the program.
You're looking lovely too, Llewellyn.
Long may you live.
That is our show. BF Cheer, the good old days weren't bad, and they weren't that great either. All the best. Cheers.